This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear Johanna Fernandez talking about her new book, The Young Lords, A Radical History. We learn about a massive air surveillance project underway in Baltimore. ACLU attorney David Rokha joins us to understand how and why the police department there contracted with the company Persistence Surveillance Systems to monitor 90% of the city's residents all day long, everywhere they go. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Protests in the streets in the wake of police killings of Black Americans have sparked a multifaceted societal reckoning with racism. Challenges to entrenched systems of inequality and white supremacy are taking many forms, from the tearing down of Confederate statues to calls for police reform, the defunding of certain police functions, and even abolition of police. To Merriam-Webster Dictionary, expanding its definition of racism to include structural forms of bias. Historically, the role of street protests is so intrinsic to reform in this nation that protection for mass assemblies is enshrined in the Bill of Rights. Yet one vibrant and impactful group of revolutionary activists has received virtually no attention, namely the Young Lords. The children of poor and working-class Puerto Rican migrants, who'd been massively displaced from the island of Puerto Rico to U.S. mainland after World War II, the Young Lords grew up in neighborhoods like the South Bronx and East Harlem. They were radicalized by the civil rights and Black Power movements, and also by the Vietnam War. This generation of socialist youth made it their top priority to bring about revolution in the U.S. and on the island of Puerto Rico. Scholar and activist Johanna Fernandez's new book, The Young Lords, A Radical History, is the definitive history of this militant group of community organizers. In a presentation at Baltimore's Red Emma Worker Cooperative Bookstore in early 2020, Professor Fernandez discussed the long-lasting impact of their theatrical street initiatives. The Young Lords form part of a generation that transformed the relationship between white people and people of color in the U.S. and made it acceptable to question how the U.S. government conducts foreign policy. Their activism has been credited for the passage of anti-lead poisoning legislation in the city, and they drafted the first known patient Bill of Rights. They did so in concert with nurses, doctors, and hospital workers at Lincoln Hospital, which they occupied 50 years ago on July 14, 1969, to protest health care for profit in America and the poor conditions in the delivery of health care to Black American and Puerto Rican patients in that Bronx hospital. We go now to hear Johanna Fernandez talking about her new book, The Young Lords, A Radical History.
Upon arrival in the United States mainland, these migrants faced another series of displacements. Urban renewal, which was that era's version of gentrification, the rise of permanent unemployment as a consequence of deindustrialization, dilapidated housing, police brutality, super exploitation in the city's garment industry, where 70% of Puerto Ricans worked, and the attempt on the part of the city to strip Puerto Ricans of their dignity. Part of what's been fascinating for me to see is that if you read the newspapers of the time, Puerto Ricans were depicted in the media much like Mexicans have been depicted in this period, as bad hombres, criminals, but also mild-mannered people. So you might not recall, but 6 years ago, 7 years ago, Mexicans were depicted as mild-mannered people because they are the super exploited class in American society who are vulnerable to deportation. Well, Puerto Ricans worked the hardest jobs in New York. They were super exploited. They were known as mild-mannered, but eventually they were demonized, criminalized. Part of what the young lords did was that they essentially stood up for Puerto Ricans and transformed the perception of Puerto Ricans in New York City through their militant organizing. The young lords exposed these unforgiving conditions, linked them to U.S. colonial rule in Puerto Rico, to capitalism and imperial war in places like Vietnam. And in the context of radicalization and the growing awareness that Puerto Ricans were colonial subjects, the children of Puerto Rican migration explored the commonality of experience between Puerto Ricans and African Americans. On the ground, the young lords became known for their militant and dramatic community-based organizing. In Chicago, the young lords helped beat back urban renewal. In New York, they engaged in militant community organizing around medical discrimination in the area of health. They blocked traffic with neighborhood garbage to protest poor sanitation conditions. They exposed childhood lead poisoning. They took over a hospital, Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx, and they drafted the first known patient bill of rights. And they are credited with the passage of anti-lead poisoning legislation in New York. And they did all of this in collaboration with workers in hospitals, technicians, but also doctors, and they engaged in militant action in the streets, but they also went door to door testing children for lead poisoning. And they exposed the fact that something like 30% of the children they tested in New York were lead positive. Lead is a neurotoxin that causes permanent brain damage. And there were a series of children who died in East Harlem because of lead poisoning. And they just muckraked and exposed the crisis in the streets through press conferences. They occupied the office of the Department of Health, and eventually they took over a hospital to dramatize the horrific conditions of health in the city. And they called their campaigns offensives in solidarity with the Tet Offensive of the Vietnamese in 1968. For example, they called the garbage campaign the garbage offensive. And as you might know, the Tet Offensive was the most important military operation launched by the Vietnamese in 1968. It was the campaign that surprised Americans in the cities rather than in the jungle, as the Vietnamese were engaged in struggle in the jungle. And they lost, the Vietnamese lost the military operation, but it was actually captured by the media in the city. And with that offensive, others began to challenge U.S. imperialism around the world. But the United States intervention in Vietnam pretty much to grind to a halt after that. So what were the politics of the Young Lords? And I think it's important to note that they emerged in 1969, both in Chicago and New York, at the height of radicalization during this period. They were not only community organizers. They were revolutionaries who were combining the idea of building a broad social movement with the notion of building a revolutionary party. The socialist tradition in the United States has done one thing or the other. There have been very few moments wherein socialists have been able to successfully build community-based or workplace-based campaigns and retain a structure of revolutionary politics. And the Young Lords were successful because they were able to do both. They built community campaigns, they built a broader movement, but they also build a revolutionary party. And they are among the few waves of socialists who are people of color who built movements in the United States. They were doing this at a moment when 2 million students said that they believed in the importance of building a revolutionary party. So that helped tremendously. That consciousness had moved profoundly to the left by the end of the 1960s. And they were also self-identified revolutionary nationalists who championed the independence of Puerto Rico. they called themselves Marxist-Leninists, and they were influenced by the Cuban Revolution. This is the church they occupied, by the way. They also occupied a church, and they used the media to essentially convince people of East Harlem that it was a good idea that they were taking over a church, and I can talk about that some more. If you can move forward, this is the breakfast program that they established. They turned the church into a social sanctuary for the poor, held free community clinics at the church, and here they're trying to build socialism in the hospital that they occupied in the Bronx. They were influenced by social service politics of the period, but they married this social service-oriented activism to a revolutionary socialist politics. They're influenced by the Cuban Revolution, and this is something that folks might not recognize, that the Black Panthers wore berets in solidarity with the Cuban Revolution. They also published a newspaper, which they called Palante, and they developed the 13-point program. It was different from the Black Panther 10-point program, but ultimately the Young Lords were successful because they adopted the structure of organization and political model pre-established by the Black Panther Party. They essentially mimicked the organizational form of the Black Panther Party, and that allowed them to take off as they did with the community organizing. The first point of their platform read, "We want self-determination for Puerto Ricans, liberation on the island and inside the United States." Its final point, number 13, read, "We want a socialist society." For the purposes of this talk, I want to underscore that the Young Lords, like the Black Panthers, were socialists. And this is important for thinking about the question asked, what's the significance of the Young Lords and the Black Panthers for this period, especially given that we're in election season. They believed that society should be organized around human need, not on the basis of profit as under capitalism, and that workers and ordinary people could democratically reorganize society and run it in the interests of the many. When they looked around the world to assess problems, they emphasized that class conflict is central and universal in society. In other words, that the world is divided between the poor and the rich, that working people produce all the goods and services in society, but that the rich and their governments control how those goods are distributed and what the priorities of society are. And that only a revolution could resolve this fundamental conflict and inequality. They emphasize that classes exist among racially oppressed people. Therefore, they decried conservative and cultural forms of nationalism, which called for unity on the basis of race and ethnicity alone, as in the example of declaring Puerto Rican independence only to build Puerto Rican capitalism. And they also drew from the example of the Black Panthers, who called cultural nationalists pork chop nationalists and lambasted them for being more concerned with making money selling dashikis than with real revolution. These are the articles that they published in their newspapers. They were reading all kinds of literature, Marxist literature, but also the literature emerging from third world liberation movements. And they were people from the communities in which they were organizing who wrote articles in a language that was very accessible to the and a style that reflected the culture in which they lived. So they were really organically grounded in the community. These were people from the community who became revolutionaries and went back to the community to organize among the people in workplaces and in the schools. Movements are not measured in terms of duration. They're measured in terms of impact and the extent to which they shift consciousness. They transform the public debate about what's accepted or not and how we understand social problems, but also how we live. And this is why the New Left is so important. So the Young Lords are part of the New Left, and we don't consistently study the 60s necessarily in American society. We don't necessarily get to the 60s in high school, and a lot of college professors don't teach the 60s. But the 60s are important because they produced a cultural revolution in the United States. In many ways, they civilized American society. The New Left radically changed the relationship between white people and people of color in the United States. This is why the New Left matters. So the New Left changed the relationship between white people and people of color, and in particular, the relationship between white people and black people, which is why folks get fired today when they say racist things, because the civil rights and black power movements established different standards for how we conduct ourselves in public. Racism and white supremacy became unacceptable in American society. It's the reason why Obama became president and why, for example, someone like Ellen is as popular as she is. So the 60s also made acceptable a questioning of U.S. foreign policy. This is in the aftermath of the Cold War, where it wasn't acceptable to criticize American foreign policy, but it also challenged the nation's assumptions about issues of gender and sexuality. So everything that we accept as normal, even despite the existence of Trump in office, but everything we accept as normal, the fact that I'm here, that I teach at a university as a black woman, that Ellen is in the public sphere, all of these cultural changes were a result of these fierce struggles that happened in the 1960s. I'll end with a significant portion of my book, part of what I learned pretty early on, which is something that is not necessarily acknowledged, is that a lot of the activism of the Young Lords and the Black Panthers was organized around health. And I was one of the first people to actually write about this. I wrote an article about this more than 10 years ago because it was puzzling. It's not necessarily something that you expect young, fierce revolutionaries with a lot of testosterone doing, right? When we think about these organizations, they're at least perceived as very masculine, macho organizations. How is it that they end up doing all of this work around health? And even though we don't realize this, this trend was begun by the Black Panther Party. So the Black Panther Party organized ambulance services in cities like Pittsburgh. They did tuberculosis testing. They did work around lead poisoning. It was the Black Panther Party that initiated protests at Lincoln Hospital. They took, before the Young Lords got there, they took over a mental health clinic to organize it in the interests of the people. And you probably don't know this, but that's why the Panther 21 were arrested. So you know about the Panther 21. All of the members of the Panther 21 had been engaged in the occupation and takeover of a mental health clinic in the Bronx before the police, the NYPD, zeroed in on them and arrested them all. That pretty much led to the decline of activism on the part of the Black Panther in New York City. And the Young Lords then took the helm and continued with the work around health. So as the children, and this is what I concluded, why health? And I was just trying to put the puzzle together for quite some time. As the children of the first large wave of non-English-speaking Puerto Rican migrants to the city, the Young Lords and their peers grew up bilingual. They were indispensable language and cultural interpreters who helped their parents and neighbors navigate the inhospitable bureaucratic institutions of New York. And the New York hospitals were among the most frequented of such institutions, second only to the public schools. The Young Lords during the period describe enduring alienating visits to hospitals as children, where as intermediaries for their parents, they were able to perceive at a very young age quote, how these institutions viewed us versus how we viewed ourselves. As children, they witnessed the stigma and indignity of discrimination, of long waiting hours at the emergency room, and the improper care their parents received, all in the context of illness when people feel most human and most vulnerable. And part of what I argue in the book is that the experience of this generation of young migrants in these public institutions, in the schools, in the hospitals, in the streets, establish the foundation of an organic early radicalization that then matured and became organized as a consequence of the rise of the civil rights movement. So Puerto Ricans, unlike other Latinos, they migrated into the civil rights and black power movements and anti-war movements and were profoundly influenced by the period. This experience of these young people translating for their parents in hospitals that had not yet been civilized rankled them to the core. And this wasn't just any period. The demographic shifts and economic changes of the post-war period created a health crisis of epic proportion for the city and its poor and working class people. So you probably know that the post-World War II period produced a city that was poorer and more divided by race and class than ever before in the history of the city because of white flight. So there was not just white flight, there was also a process of deindustrialization happening in cities like Baltimore, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago. We tend to think of deindustrialization as a white working class thing. But before deindustrialization hit white workers, it devastated communities of color because deindustrialization began to take root in American cities immediately after World War II in cities like Detroit, New York, etc. So independently of the experience of racism, which itself is a complex health risk, these new migrants of color were undergoing a series of displacements which would have profound consequences for their physical and mental health. Displacement abounded in the form of Operation Bootstrap. Migration is a profound displacement. And this happened not just to Puerto Ricans, but also to Mexicans who were migrating to the city during this period, and Black Americans who were migrating from the South. Deindustrialization is another mass displacement, but also urban renewal. Not sure if you know that 22,000 Puerto Rican families were displaced from the neighborhood where Lincoln Center was built in New York City. In 1959, urban renewal, gentrification of that time, essentially raised one of the most vibrant Puerto Rican neighborhoods, known for its street performers and its drummers. And in the rubble was filmed West Side Story, by the way. In the rubble of that very vibrant neighborhood, they filmed West Side Story. The filmmakers of West Side Story decided to do the filming there, but then Lincoln Center was built. Social psychiatrist Dr. Mindy Fullilove calls social displacement, quote, root shock. This is what she writes. Root shock, she explains, quote, undermines trust, increases anxiety, destabilizes relationships, destroys social, emotional, and financial resources, and increases the risk of every kind of stress-related disease from depression to heart attack. Unsurprisingly, in the 1960s, poor Black Americans and Puerto Ricans began to make more trips to New York's hospitals than white Americans. This was the moment when, for the first time, urban people began to use emergency rooms for all manner of non-emergency conditions. You know, we know the statistics that people of color use the emergency room as their doctor. Well, this was the moment when it started. in part because these changes were completely new, this massive displacement. The exponential increase of these visits was fueled by the higher risk of the higher incidence of sickness as a consequence of root shock, but also, I mean, I literally spent years trying to figure this out. During this period, part of what we see is white flight to the suburbs. But who leaves with white flights? The mom and pop corner doctors. So in neighborhoods like East Harlem and Harlem, what we see is a 30% decrease in doctors who had previously served poor immigrant, European immigrant populations. But now the corner doctors were gone. They left with white flight out of the city. People of color were forced for the first time to go to hospitals for care, the new migrants, in ways that previous generations of migrants to the cities had not. And part of what we see in hospitals is a more kind of structural racism where you're being funneled into a process truly has not been civilized. So the medical profession in this period was quite prejudiced, even if you weren't a person of color. So I'll end by saying that essentially, radicals in the 60s expanded the nation's definition of the common good around sanitation and the notion that we have a right to decent services offered and extended by the city. And the Patient Bill of Rights is an example of that. And before I end, I just want to read from the Patient Bill of Rights.
As Professor Fernandez writes in her book, quote, "The New York Young Lords form part of a cohort of young working class people, and people of color among them in particular, whose unprecedented access to higher education sharpened their latent critique of society and afforded them an infrastructure for dissent. They challenged what many believed were old, soul-slaying social norms and standards of behavior that constrained personal freedoms in the U.S. Known collectively as the New Left, these diverse movements were built by a generation whose activism radically changed the cultural and political landscape of the United States."
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
As the nation erupts in protests against racially infused police violence, the Baltimore Police Department has just launched a 6-month daytime aerial surveillance experiment. A Texas billionaire has funded the project that's being operated by an Ohio-based company, Persistent Surveillance Systems. Airplanes fly overhead and record the movements of nearly everyone in the city. Michael Harrison, Baltimore's police commissioner, justified the nearly $4 million experiment by saying, quote, "There is no expectation of privacy on a public street." He clarified that the airplanes will not film while individuals are inside their homes. The Aerial Investigation Research Pilot Program, as it's called, is by contract limited to monitoring such felony crimes as robberies, carjackings, shootings, and homicides. In theory, the images recorded are to be used only in criminal investigations and will be stored for 45 days. A first prong of the program was conducted covertly in 2016 under a different police commissioner. The ACLU of Maryland calls this initiative the most comprehensive surveillance of a U.S. city in history. ACLU senior staff attorney David Rocha likens it to having a police officer follow you every time you walk out of the door. David joins us today with an update on this aerial surveillance program. He worked on a number of significant cases involving free speech, police misconduct, privacy, election law, and more. In 2011, David was an inaugural recipient of the James Baldwin Medal for Civil Rights. Previously, he worked as a senior trial attorney in the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice, where he focused on police misconduct and conditions in prisons, jails, and other state institutions. David Rocha, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on.
David, in April, a federal court decision allowed an aerial surveillance program to move forward in Baltimore. But this isn't the first time Baltimore has had such a program. When was the first, and what, if anything, is different about this one?
This was originally rolled out in Baltimore in secret in 2016, so secret that at the time it was secret from the state's attorney's office, the mayor, the city council, the Office of the Public Defender, the Criminal Defense Bar, the entire city of Baltimore. The only people who knew it was happening then were the Baltimore Police Department and Ross McNutt, the owner of Persistent Surveillance Systems, the company that has developed this technology and has been looking to deploy it in the United States. When the secret use of this persistent aerial surveillance was disclosed in a Bloomberg Businessweek article, there was, unsurprisingly, a huge uproar, and it was shut down. And since then, Ross McNutt has been trying mightily to convince Baltimore and other cities to use his persistent surveillance technology. And sadly and pathetically, Baltimore decided to become the guinea pig, or I should say the mayor and police commissioner decided that Baltimore should become the guinea pig for this technology in December of last year, and it was deployed, or it was planned to be deployed starting in April. We sued to block the use of this persistent wide area surveillance of the entire city. But sadly, as you noted, the U.S. District Court here declined to grant a preliminary injunction against it, and that is now on appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Now, who actually funded this pilot program? I understand it's a Texas billionaire. Is that the owner of Persistent Surveillance?
No, the Texas billionaires are the Arnolds, and they are funding, to the tune of about $3 million, the six-month so-called pilot of this technology here. Ross McNutt is the owner and founder of Persistent Surveillance Systems, the company that markets this surveillance technology. He developed it when he was in the military for use in the Iraq War as a way of attempting to track insurgents who were planting improvised explosive devices. And then when he came back home, saw an opportunity to try to market the technology to law enforcement as a crime-fighting tool.
Why not a drone? I was surprised to hear the technology was being used in an airplane since they're so much more expensive.
Right. I think that's because there are still limits on flying large drones in U.S. airspace, or non-military drones, that is. But if the surveillance technology is allowed to go forward, that is obviously the next step in order to try to bring costs down, because obviously drones can be flown far less expensively than crewed Cessna aircraft, which is where the cameras are, how the cameras are currently deployed.
Now, because airplanes and drones can remain airborne for protracted periods of time, unlike still cameras, they can capture continuous records of an individual's activities. The mayor has said that no one has an expectation of privacy in public places, but how does protracted surveillance reconcile with the Fourth Amendment?
You're right. This technology is categorically different from the ground-based surveillance cameras or one-time flyovers that we are more familiar with in this country. And this technology is the most far-reaching surveillance system ever deployed on American soil. It's important to understand how it works and what it does. So it uses a network of very sophisticated wide-angle cameras which capture in each frame one-third of the city. But the resolution of these networked cameras is sufficient to be able to zoom in and distinguish one person from another. And the cameras record video at the rate of one frame per second, thus creating a slow frame rate video record of everywhere that everybody in Baltimore goes anytime they're outside while the planes are flying. And the planes fly about 12 hours a day. The plan in the current contract is to have three planes in the air at a time, covering more than 90% of the land area of Baltimore. And the net result is a virtual time machine, allowing the police to go to any location and any time, and then trace the movements of every person to and from that location. And the identification, so what the proponents of this, what Ross McNutt and the police commissioner are fond of saying, is that the cameras can't identify anyone, which is the kind of truthy but deeply misleading statement that really hides what's going on here. So it is true that in a single frame of the video footage, because of the resolution and because of the angle of the videography, you can't look at a single frame and know who the person, who any of the dots, any of the people photographed are. But it's worth remembering that this technology was developed for one and only one reason and is being deployed for one and only one reason, and that is to identify people. And it does that in multiple ways. So first, simply by tracing where someone comes from and goes to, that is often sufficient to identify who that quote-unquote dot is. In Baltimore, 75% of the population lives in a single-family house. And so if you know where they leave in the morning and where they go to at night, you can pretty reliably identify them. But identification also works in other ways by being linked to the city's network of ground-based video surveillance cameras so that they will know precisely at what time the person they're tracking has moved past a particular camera, and they can then grab a video image of the person that they're interested in. It's also linked to the city's network of automated license plate readers, which track and identify vehicles, and they can also know when the person has passed private video surveillance cameras that individuals have put in businesses or homes, to the extent those are registered with the city, and many are. So there's multiple ways in which identification takes place. And in terms of the Fourth Amendment, what PSS and the mayor and the police commissioner have pointed to is a number of Supreme Court cases dating back several decades, which said that aerial observation of public places does not violate the Fourth Amendment, which is true. But as the court itself made clear in those cases, what they were talking about there was static observation of a particular place at a particular time, not the tracking of the movements of an entire city during daylight hours. And as to that, the relevant Supreme Court opinion is the court's most recent decision in the Carpenter case involving law enforcement acquisition of long-term location tracking data, in that case from cellular service providers. And what the court held in that case was because that movement data is so revealing of private the details of life, and because the data is available as to almost everyone, since we all carry cell phones, that allowing the warrantless acquisition of that data by the government would so alter the balance of power and privacy and structure of our society that they said that acquisition of that data as to even a single person was a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. And here, of course, we're not talking about the acquisition of long-term location data about one person, but the acquisition of long-term location tracking information about every single person in Baltimore.
This seems to be the perfect case to bring to the Supreme Court for consideration.
Well, I hope it doesn't have to go that far, but this is game-changing technology. No government in the United States has ever had the power to record, store, track, and have at its fingertips the movement data of the entire population. And I think to give the government that power is profoundly dangerous and profoundly invasive of privacy. It's the technological equivalent of having a police officer follow you every time you walk out the door of whatever building you happen to be in and record where you're going. And if that happened in real life, I think we would all viscerally and clearly understand the privacy implications. And of course, it couldn't happen in real life. It's only because of these sophisticated new technologies that it can happen. You know, because it's being done remotely from an airplane, we don't have the same visceral experience. But the dangers are exactly the same. The dangers are, frankly, worse than when the government acquires the information about a single person through a warrant process. Here, there's no court involved at all, ever. The government simply tracks the movement of everybody all the time to be used whenever it wants, and that's really dangerous. And that's, you know, that's the basis for our challenge, and I hope the courts will see it the same way.
David, do you think that the Baltimore Police Department shares the data they collect from this persistent surveillance systems with the feds?
Nothing would prevent them from doing so. Do I know that they're doing so now? There is no way for me to know. What they've said they're doing now is a six-month trial of the program, and the only policies or privacy protections, if you want to call them that, that exist in a contract between the BPD and persistent surveillance systems, which is completely meaningless because nobody can enforce that other than the BPD or PSS itself, and neither of whom has any actual interest in enforcing it. There's obviously no ability for the public to enforce it. And, of course, contractual terms can change at will, and nothing would prohibit the BPD from sharing information with any other law enforcement agency, federal or otherwise. So this is literally the privacy nightmare come to life, this kind of all-seeing eye that tracks us everywhere we go outside is what people who are concerned about the rapid development of technology and privacy and limits on government power have been worried about for decades. And here it is, with Baltimore being the guinea pig for the rollout of this technology.
Why do you think Baltimore was picked as the test city, as it were?
Well, I mean, part of it is a function of the fact that the police department in 2016, shockingly, was willing to secretly deploy the technology without telling anybody, which is just such a, sort of appalling and sick statement in and of itself about policing in Baltimore. Baltimore is unique, certainly in Maryland and perhaps in the whole country, in being a city in which the people of Baltimore have no direct control over their police department, because the police department, dating back to the Civil War era, is statutorily declared to be a state entity, with the city solicitor then taking the position that that means that the Baltimore City Council has no authority to legislate about it or regulate it. And so these decisions are made simply by the police commissioner, who is accountable to no one other than the mayor. And so you have a culture of impunity, basically, which is why the Baltimore Police Department is under a consent decree with the Department of Justice from decades of racist and unconstitutional policing. Obviously, Baltimore is not unique in the country in that regard. But in its lack of accountability, I think it is somewhat unique. And so, I think part of it is because Ross McNutt already had a toehold here, and because he was able to, I think, cynically exploit the misery that this city is experiencing with persistently high murder rates and a sense of panic about crime. He was able to sell it as, we're desperate, nothing is working, and here's my magic solution.
In our remaining minutes, I wanted to note that when you talked about lack of enforceability, I read that the contract, one of the provisions is that the data is only to be used in conjunction with felony crimes in Baltimore, and also that it is supposed to be deleted in 45 days. But of course, we have no way, as you say, of enforcing that or knowing if it's happening.
Well, it's worse than that. When it was used in secret, PSS has publicly said, once it was disclosed, we're very concerned about privacy. We delete the data after 45 days. That was what they said back in 2016. That turned out to be a bald-faced lie. As was discovered when the public defender sought data related to cases it was working on and found that the data had been kept indefinitely, which was confirmed in a report written by the Police Foundation, which revealed that what really was happening was that after 45 days, it was just being moved to a different server, not deleted. There's something just really sick about the fact that here's a company which deployed this technology in secret, lied to our faces about what it was doing, and yet is given a $3 million contract to do it all over again. It's like giving the keys to your house to the person who just burglarized it. It's just, at some level, utterly incomprehensible, and perhaps only could happen in Baltimore.
David, I was surprised when you just said there are three planes. I thought it was just one plane. I know that some residents of Baltimore have complained about the noise, but is there any kind of groundswell, especially as we see what's happening in the streets with racialized police murders? and activism calling for changes. What do residents say about these planes?
Well, you know, there's obviously, unsurprisingly, a mix of opinion in Baltimore. There are many people who are deeply opposed to this. There are some people who are so focused on crime and the police department's inability to make a dent in the murder rate that they think this is the appropriate solution. There's certainly many people who think that the way we should be approaching our crime problem in Baltimore, not just with respect to murder, but more generally, is to focus on more proven strategies and community-based solutions like the Safe Streets programs, which employs violence interrupters to be out in the community and seeking to diffuse conflicts before they get to the level of shootings, and which where they've been deployed have been quite successful. But, you know, they're not getting $3 million grants from the Arnolds or anyone else, and there's something really warped and wrong about that. So there is certainly plenty of people who are deeply concerned about it, and the person who just won the mayoral primary, the Democratic mayoral primary here in Baltimore, Brandon Scott, is someone who has been an opponent of using this kind of technology and persistent surveillance. So that's a good sign. I think there were a number of mayoral candidates who were outspoken proponents of this, all of whom were far back in the field. So I think that says something about the level of public support for this in Baltimore.
And what, if anything, is the ACLU doing in terms of a next step about this?
Yeah, so as I said, we filed suit to block it. We were unsuccessful in getting a preliminary injunction in the district court. We've appealed that denial of a preliminary injunction to the U.S. Court of Appeals, asked for and received an accelerated briefing schedule. That appeal is now fully briefed, and we hope will be decided quickly, and we hope that the Fourth Circuit will agree with our Fourth Amendment analysis and issue a preliminary injunction or overturn the district court's denial of the preliminary injunction, and that will halt it. We also have, with help from our national office, engaged in a significant advertising effort here, seeking to raise public awareness of what's going on. We see that reflected in the protests that are happening now, with people specifically calling out this program in the protests that are happening in Baltimore. And we're hopeful, either through the legal process or the political process, that this will be stopped. It's a travesty that it's happening.
Well, we also don't want this spreading to other areas throughout the country.
I think that's a real danger, and why we felt compelled to sue, and why we've opposed it both locally and nationally in every forum.
Unfortunately, our time has come to an end. How can our listeners learn more about your work and the work of the Baltimore ACLU?
Information about this case and all of our other work is on our website, www.aclu-md.org, and on our national office website. Our national office has been leading the litigation effort here, and that's at aclu.org.
David, thank you for all your work on these issues and for being a guest today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on and for your attention to this important issue.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.